announcement before we get started. We have available today for the first time the anniversary edition of The Fingerprint of God. It's the first book we brought out at Reasons to Believe more than 20 years ago, 22 years ago now. And I think what's special about it is it has a photo session of about 20 pages in the middle that documents the history of Reasons to Believe. So for the first time, it's available over here at this table. And next week, this just arrived late Friday afternoon, Fuzz's latest book, Creating Life in the Lab. And you know, it's still in pallets, but we'll have a box available next week for you. And it's one of the most exciting books I've had a chance to read. Fuzz documents the research efforts of trying to make life in the lab. They're not making it from scratch, but they're taking different bacteria, breaking them down into biochemical pieces, then putting the pieces back together in a different way with the hope that they can revolutionize biotechnology, you know, develop bacteria, for example, that will eat up all of our waste and garbage, things like that. So anyway, you can read about it, and Fuzz uses an argument saying, look at all the technology that was needed to do these very simple steps, how much more would be necessary to make life from scratch 3.83 billion years ago. We'll have that here next week. Yes?
Just a quick comment on that. If anyone's here ever done any computer coding, if you take someone else's code and modify it, or use it, it's a lot easier than starting with a clean sheet of paper. A whole lot easier.
Very much so. As a former computer programmer, I can definitely testify to that. Yes? That's right. That would be even harder to do. All right. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I saw a wonderful show on Nat Geo or something on the how the universe works. And on that, of course, you already know that. Everybody knows that when a supernova explodes, that's what the sun is going to do it. It scatters all the building blocks of life all over the universe. So you would say, well, you know, there's got to be life all over the universe because the building blocks are there, and they come from these stars. That's where we came from. So, you know, that to me, that's the beginning. You know, the other stuff is way down the
line. Well, as you know, Al, all of us in this classroom are the products of the ashes of dead stars. But when astronomers talk about how these supernova produce the building blocks of life, what they really mean is they produce carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen. It's not exactly the building blocks of life. These are just the basic elements that form the building blocks of the building blocks of the building blocks of life. So, but it is true. You know, our bodies are made up of the ashes of previous generations of stars, and it takes a very highly fine-tuned window of time for star formation to get the elements that are necessary for life. And so you can't have life until there's been three generations of stars. But if you wait too long, you can't have it either. There's this narrow window of time when it's all possible. And as you've heard me say here before, it can only take place on a planet that is super endowed with uranium and thorium. And you know, our planet Earth has 16,000 times as much uranium as any other astrophysical body that we can measure, and has 23 times as much thorium. And it's because of that that we have continents and oceans, and because of that we can have advanced life. Anyway, I did want to talk to you a little about something else about the universe that got discovered just the past few days. And let me begin with a question. How many of you in the class have heard of the God particle? Okay, a lot of you. How many of you know what the God particle is?
No one knows.
The Higgs boson, that's right. Now, how many of you know why the Higgs boson is called the God particle? Anybody got a clue why it's called the God particle? Ah, we have a physicist in the audience. It's because the Higgs boson is presumed by particle physicists to be the agency by which other particles get mass. And it's also the fundamental particle that neatly explains how our cosmic creation model, our best cosmic creation models, consistently fit in with our best particle creation models. And that's why they call it the God particle. Only someone like God could explain this incredibly complex two different aspects of creation that beautifully fit together. And it's the Higgs boson that explains why we have mass in the universe, why it's distributed the way it is, and why it's possible that life could exist in the universe. And also points to the amazing design of the Creator that makes all this possible. So that's why it's called the God particle. And there's been books written with the title, The God Particle. Now what I want to share with you this morning, there is another fundamental particle that I believe is far more deserving of the title, the God particle. And it's gotten virtually no attention in the media, or, well, it's gotten some attention amongst theoretical physicists. In fact, what I've noticed is going through the scientific literature, there's more papers published about this particle than there is about the Higgs boson. Moreover, you see it published across a variety of disciplines. Anybody got a clue what this fundamental particle is? I just want to see if anybody's even heard of this thing that, in my opinion, is far more deserving of the title, the God particle. Pardon me? No?
Quarks?
No. Neutralino? You're close. The sterile neutrino. The sterile neutrino. What some astronomers refer to as the eunuchs of the universe. And that actually has a biblical context, because some of the most famous and godly men in the Bible were eunuchs. David, for example, was a eunuch. Daniel. The one that was the prime minister of both the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire. The reason why they call these neutrinos sterile is, unlike other neutrinos, they do not interact with photons at all, or protons or neutrons and electrons. We have three different kinds of neutrons, the tau, the electron, and the muon neutrinos. Sterile neutrino. I hope I got that right. Yeah, I did. Okay, good. Yeah, there's three other kinds of neutrinos that have all been detected, the tau neutrino, the muon, and the electron neutrino, that are referred to as WIMPs, weakly interacting mass of particles. And believe it or not, the physicists that came up with that term decided to trademark it because they were worried that some company might actually steal that and use that as a mark on one of their products. I don't think there's much risk of anybody putting out a WIMP car or a WIMP refrigerator or a WIMP TV, but they trademarked it anyway. And what's really incredible is that they forgot to trademark macho, which you would think have much more potential for use. And it's all because some TV company came up with the term quasar and said, we got to start trademarking our acronyms. Weakly interacting mass of particles. But when physicists refer to neutrinos as weakly interacting, they're not kidding. The vast majority of neutrinos that impinge the Earth pass right through the entire planet Earth without interacting with anything. Only very occasionally will a neutrino actually interact with a photon, and you can detect it. In fact, the way they detect neutrinos is they go underground thousands of feet, and they make a big cavity in a mine, and they basically fill up a cube, say, with 10,000 plus cubic feet of water, and then they surround the whole thing with photometers, and the whole goal is to catch that occasional neutrino that interacts with a photon and then pick up the light of the photon. But they have to do it deep underground in order to rule out the noise that would come from cosmic rays going through the water and causing an interaction. And so You know, if you observe for several years, you will pick up a few neutrinos with that technique. And so these neutrinos have been detected because the sun pumps out huge quantities of neutrinos, but they're very difficult to detect. But the sterile neutrinos do not interact at all. You say, well, then how on earth can we possibly detect them? Well, there was a couple of physicists, I'm trying to remember the names, Riccardo Barbieri and Alexander Dolgov, that's it, Alexander Dolgov, back in 1990, wrote a research paper where they said, they explained how sterile neutrinos can occasionally decay into ordinary neutrinos, and the neutrinos that actually have flavor, yes. Yes, they're part of what's called exotic dark matter. So ordinary matter has the property that it strongly interacts with photons. Exotic matter weakly interacts or doesn't interact at all with photons. So we've got two kinds of matter in the universe. And by the way, the exotic matter outweighs the ordinary matter by about 6 to 1. So there's almost 6 times as much exotic matter in the universe as there is ordinary matter. And ordinary matter is the stuff we're all made up of, photons, neutrons, and electrons. Planet Earth is all ordinary matter. Our sun is mostly ordinary matter, but our sun does produce through nuclear burning copious amounts of these, what we call active neutrinos, neutrinos that do weakly interact with the photons. Another property is that the ordinary neutrinos have flavors, kind of like ice cream, but the sterile neutrinos are flavorless. They have no flavor at all, and they don't interact at all. But as these two physicists, Barbieri and Dolgov, pointed out back in 1990, there is a potential that they, a sterile neutrino, can decay into an ordinary neutrino plus a photon. And with that photon, you got the possibility of detection. Now, it would be an X-ray photon, which means the only way you're going to pick this up is through an X-ray telescope, which means you've got to use a telescope that's orbiting the Earth. X-rays can't penetrate through the atmosphere of our planet. And the big problem there is lots of other things also produce X-rays. But what Barbieri and Dolgov showed is that there are particular line where X-ray radiation should be relatively sharp and would be distinct from other X-ray radiation. Consequently, the potential to detect sterile neutrinos. Now, the reason why I think it's more sterile neutrinos are more deserving of the title the God particle than the Higgs boson is they explain so very much about cosmic creation and particle creation and a lot of other things. Sterile neutrinos explain 8 different anomalies that we're dealing with in astrophysics. They explain why the first stars form so early. The first stars show up between 200 and 400 million years after the cosmic creation event, and that's been an enigma in astronomy. How can the physics of the universe possibly cause stars to be formed so early? Well, if you've got sterile neutrinos existing in a significant abundance range, you can get stars forming that early in the universe. And probably one of the most significant things, it explains why we've got any stuff at all in the universe. We don't know of any other way to explain why the universe produces more baryons and antibaryons than the existence of sterile neutrinos. Unless sterile neutrinos exist, the universe would produce equal amounts of baryons and antibaryons. And you might say, what on earth is a baryon? Well, that's a technical term that refers to anything that's made up of quarks. That would include protons and neutrons. And so your physical bodies are 99.9999% baryons. And in your body, there won't be any antibaryons. And the problem with the antibaryons is that they react very efficiently with baryons. So if you've got a baryon here and an antibaryon here, they're going to get together and annihilate one another into pure energy. Now, what we observe about the universe is its physics is structured in such a way that in the early universe, you have a ratio of 10 billion and 1 baryons for every 10 billion antibaryons. And in the very first split second of the universe, the antibaryons annihilate the baryons. But because there's a slight excess of baryons to antibaryons, we have stars, we have galaxies, we have planets, we have human beings. There'd be no galaxies, stars, or planets if these two were exactly equal in number. But because of stellar neutrinos, the existence of stellar neutrinos predicts a slight excess of baryons over antibaryons. So that's one of the most exciting things about sterile neutrinos. It explains why the universe has any matter in it at all. Yes?
Yeah, two first of all, does that help to explain the inflationary phase of the universe?
That's coming next.
And also, do these not, we know from the theoretical calculations, they don't produce antibaryons by their decay?
That physics is still being worked out. So, where they play a role is in, because in the very early universe, you have a huge population of neutrinos, much denser than we have today. And this is where they play that crucial role. So these are playing a role before the baryons even exist. Because it's the very hot plasma, soup of the universe in the very first trillionth of a second, where you get the production of quarks. So quarks don't even exist until 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the cosmic creation event. And it's this neutrino mix before 10 to the minus 11 seconds that produces the baryons. But if you don't have the sterile neutrinos, the only baryons you get are the baryons and the antibaryons, and they exist in equal numbers. So you get a slight excess this way. Okay. Sterile neutrinos also explain the rapid kickout velocities that we see in a number of pulsars. And what I mean by that is a supergiant star collapses under its gravity and explodes. We were talking about supernova just a little while ago. But with sterile neutrinos, you're going to get some of these pulsars leaving their birth site, the site where they go supernova, at a very rapid velocity. And it's something we astronomers have seen now for three decades and have been wondering, what on earth can possibly explain these very rapid kickout velocities? And the answer is stellar neutrinos will do the job. Yes?
You say there's all these species of particles that are barely detectable or not detectable. That means to me that there's could be, probably is, a whole universe of these particles around us. And my weird question is, could this explain partly, could this be where the spiritual world exists? Because we seem to weakly interact with the spiritual world. Is it possible that that's...
No, I don't think so, Ross, because these are real particles that are part of the physics of the universe, whereas the spirit realm transcends the physics of the universe.
So maybe it's part of it somehow.
Well, what we're noticing, see, we have very good measurements in astronomy that tell us that exotic matter is about six times more abundant than ordinary matter. But the only exotic matter particles we've discovered so far have been the tau, muon, and electron neutrinos. And our measurements tell us they make up just a tiny fraction of the exotic matter. So most of the exotic matter has yet to be identified. Now that's what's exciting about this discovery that was made 9 days ago, is that we now think we've got a track on what those exotic matter particles are and how they play a role in explaining the creation of the universe and the creation of all fundamental particles. That's why I'm saying is more deserving of the title the God particle, and should be really exciting news for those of us that are followers of Jesus Christ. Okay, number four on the list. They explain the abundance pattern of our process heavy elements. And by the way, I need to apologize for the technicality of all this stuff. Almost everything I'm putting up here is a little on the technical side. Let me try to break it down for you. Our process heavy elements are made in what are called core collapse supernovae. These are the really gigantic supernova eruptions. And they're responsible for producing most of the elements that are heavier than iron. And a lot of those elements are crucial for life. And so thanks to these core collapse supernovae, we have things like bismuth and silver and gold and lead, palladium, all those nice heavy elements, copper, as you may be more familiar with, are produced through these R process, what's called nucleosynthesis. But one thing that's been puzzling astronomers for years is that the abundance ratios we see of the different elements that are heavier than iron can't be explained unless they're sterile neutrinos. The numbers don't work right, but if you've got sterile neutrinos, they work out beautifully. Okay, number five, they explain energetic supernova shocks. And here we're referring to the big supernova that seem to explode with too much energy. But if you've got sterile neutrinos, you can explain the energy density that we see in a number of these supernova shocks. Okay, three more here that sterile neutrinos explain. They explain why exotic dark matter halos are so smooth and symmetric. Our anticipation was that there would be quite a bit of structure in these exotic dark matter halos. Instead, we see that they have a very high degree of symmetry and are very smooth. And also explains why you get supermassive black holes forming so early in cosmic history. I mean, when the universe is only 300 or 400 million years old, you're getting these supermassive black holes. That's quite amazing, because when we mean a supermassive black hole, it means it has a minimum of a million times the mass of our star, the Sun. And which means that you must have millions of supergiant stars that are forming, burning, erupting as supernova eruptions, and then merging together to make supermassive black holes. The only way you can get a supermassive black hole is for small black holes to merge together. And to get it up past a million, and by the way, some of them come in at as much as 9 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. But the enigma is how early they form in cosmic history. So what is it that causes them to explode so early and merge so efficiently? And then, why is it that the best cold dark matter cosmic models of the universe require the addition of some warm dark matter? Excuse me for that. I tried to get a symbol font in there. It didn't work. That's supposed to be the Greek letter lambda. But the best models we have for the universe are models of the universe where we have inflation, where it's dominated by dark energy, and where the dominant component of the matter of the universe is exotic matter, where the dominant component of that exotic matter is what we call cold dark matter. So yeah, what defines cold dark matter? Particles that move at low velocities relative to the velocity of light. But now our models have become sophisticated enough that we realize if it's all cold dark matter, it can't explain our observations. It must be predominantly cold with an addition of warm. Now, the thing about the sterile neutrinos, they're warm. The ordinary neutrinos are cold, but the sterile neutrinos are warm, which means that hot dark matter is matter that moves at relativistic velocities. Cold dark matter, low velocities, warm is somewhere in between. Not quite relativistic, but still very fast. And so because sterile neutrinos can explain all eight of these enigmas, astronomers are utterly convinced sterile neutrinos must exist, even though we've not seen them until a few days ago. That's kind of the announcement. Yes, in the back.
I'm sure to a scientist this seems like everyday stuff. I mean, they encompass the stuff every day. But to a layman, if from a view several steps back, it is staggering. Just like looking at the internal working of the cell, it's staggering. And to a layman like myself, I can't imagine how a scientist could have any other view but the view that the early scientists had, that they were discovering God's creation.
Well, again, that's why I'm claiming this is more deserving of a title than God particle, because all eight of these things not only require sterile neutrinos, they require that the abundance in energy levels and the geography of the location of these sterile neutrinos must be fine-tuned. So you're getting dozens and dozens of design arguments throughout this whole set of eight, and there may be more things that they explain. And this is kind of where I'm going with this, is that a couple of physicists have actually identified not only the probable existence of these sterile neutrinos for the first time, but also the characteristics that these sterile neutrinos may take. So this is going to, in my opinion, be a revolution in new arguments for the supernatural design of the universe for the benefit of life and human beings in particular. Yes, Al.
So the sterile neutrinos and the Higgs boson, they're working on trying to find it now. What is the smallest particle so far that we've actually seen when they smash all these atoms together?
The smallest mass particle that we've detected so far is the neutrino.
Neutrino. So that's the
Active neutrino.
Okay, but that's not to say that's the last one.
Oh, no.
And what I'm saying is entirely too much work for God. Come on. And what is the string?
Well, God doesn't get tired, Al.
The string theory, what has that got to do with it? Now, that comes along, and how is that tied in with these particles that can't see?
Okay. String theory may or may not play a role in this. I mean, this is research that's being done independent of string theory. And I think what's really exciting to me as a taxpayer, too, is that we had the presumption that the only way we could go to detect these kinds of particles, like the Higgs boson, the sterile neutrino, would be through very expensive particle accelerators. And what Silk and Pulkroff are pointing out is that we can use cheap astronomical observations to pull it off, although we're detecting different properties of the Higgs boson, the sterile neutrino, and possibly a much lighter particle called the axion, that we now have the potential to do this without these $9 billion particle accelerators, although the $9 billion particle accelerator could give us additional information on these particles. So yeah, what it looks like is that the astronomers are going to find these particles before people at CERN in France and Switzerland find them. Again, in the back.
One of the things that's interesting to me is how, and this happens all the time, how two different groups of people can look at the same evidence and draw starkly different conclusions. Like this is too complex for God, or this is too complex for spontaneous self-generation.
Well, the reason why people say it's too complex for God is they say everything we look at, it appears to be created by a God that appreciates elegance, beauty, and simplicity. And so what I was taught when I was a freshman physics student is the right answer is always the most elegant answer, the most beautiful answer, and the simplest answer. But the problem is this. We human beings often presume that the solutions to the problems we're studying in science are simpler than they really are. And we overlook the fact that God's actually doing many more things than we think he's doing. And so now we're realizing, hey, wait a minute. We thought the universe was rather simply structured. And every time you dig into it a little more deeply, you see that God's about doing a lot more than we ever dreamed of. And you know, as you'll see in my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, the physics of the universe has a lot to do with what exists outside the universe. God is using this universe as a teaching tool for the angelic realm. He's using this universe to prepare us for a realm beyond this universe, the new creation. And so we should expect that the universe will have more complexity, and we see at the first sight. On the other hand, I would agree with this. If we understand all of God's purposes for designing the universe the way he did, it will be the simplest possible design. The problem is we don't know everything that God is doing or all of his purposes for making it, and so we tend to underestimate the degree of complexity that's necessary. Yes?
I don't think that it's too hard for God to do. Nothing's too hard. But I think it's hard for us to get our head around the fact that he would go to all this trouble for us.
Right.
I think that's the part that we're in denial.
That's very interesting.
Well, another part of the denial is this. I think we as scientists would love to be able to come up with a complete solution. And every time we think we're on the verge of a complete solution, we discover that the universe is more complicated than we thought. Frankly, I think that no matter how much we learn about the universe, we'll never learn everything. And that means that we're going to be in even more trouble when we get ushered into the new creation, because obviously that's far more complex than the universe we live in right now. Yes?
You talk about high velocity and low velocity neutrinos. Sterile neutrinos being the high speed? Or
well, they're higher speed. What's what we call warm matter. It's not hot, but it's warm.
Well, okay, and you compare that to the speed of light.
Yes.
Okay, and so that when you... I mean, are you talking about a uniform velocity? Are you talking about like the magnetic...
Well, it's a range of velocities. They're not all moving at the same velocity.
Okay, so it's like the kinetic theories where you have molecules hit against each other.
Right. It's similar to that.
Internal velocities as opposed to a mean mass velocity.
Yeah. I mean, just like when you're looking at a pot of boiling water, if the water molecules are moving slowly, we call it cold. If it's moving fast, we call it hot. So it's a similar principle. That's kind of where the astronomers got these terms from. It's not really warm like we think it is warm, but it's the same principle that's involved here. Okay, now, here's the problem with the search for sterile neutrinos. Astronomers and physicists have been looking for sterile neutrinos now for over 20 years, and they've not been able to find them. But what happened just a few days ago in the Astrophysical Journal is that a physicist and astronomer combined to say, we think we know why we've been unsuccessful in finding these sterile neutrinos, even though we know they must exist at a high abundance level. All this tells us they must exist at a high abundance level. And, the spectral line I was talking to you about, in the X-ray line, it's going to be most sharp and distinct when you're looking at clumps of exotic dark matter where there's very little ordinary dark matter. And so the best place to look for that would be what we call ultra-dwarf galaxies. Because ultra-dwarf galaxies have their primordial exotic matter, but they have not done much in the way of star formation. And so this is a place where you can see the X-ray line without a lot of noise being generated from the ordinary matter. And so astronomers for the past 20 years have been busy searching all these little tiny galaxies that are orbiting our Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. I mean, dwarf galaxies are everywhere in the universe, but you're only going to be able to measure them with precision if they're really close. And so maybe you haven't heard of Segway 1. That's considered to be the densest of the ultra-dwarf galaxies, and that's kind of been the focal point of the search. Another one's called Wilman 1. So Wilman 1 and Segway 1 have been kind of the targets. But all they've come up with is upper limits. And the upper limits are surprisingly low, too low to really explain these eight things. Well, what this physicist, Joseph Silk, is probably most famous for writing popular-level books on Big Bang cosmology. Some of the best books on Big Bang cosmology have been written by Joseph Silk. And he got together with a Russian astronomer, Dmitry Porkrov, and they came up and said, I think we've misidentified where sterile neutrinos can be detected. He says, we've been looking at the decay path of a sterile neutrino into an ordinary neutrino. He says, instead, I think we need to be looking at the decay of an inflaton into a sterile neutrino. Now, that's another particle, inflaton. What are inflatons? Inflatons are fundamental particles that were superabundant when the universe was extremely young that are responsible for the inflation of the universe. Many of you probably heard about the inflationary hot Big Bang model. That's a model of the universe where the universe continuously expands from the creation event, but between 10 to the minus 35 and 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the cosmic creation event, which is approximately a trainth of a trainth of a trainth of a second after the cosmic creation event, the universe undergoes hyperinflation, where it literally expands millions of times faster than it expands today. And it really explains why the universe is thermally connected. And the thermal connectedness of the universe is a crucial requirement for life. But it's also crucial that the universe only be about 14 billion years old. Without inflation, in order to get the universe as big as it is, you would need quadrillions of years and more. But because of inflation, everything works out beautifully so that you can have life at the right time in cosmic history and have the universe have the appropriate characteristics. Well, for a long time, particle physicists have presumed that there's these inflatons, and the inflatons are the fundamental particles that generate the inflation field that produces the hyperexpansion. But what Silk and Prokhorov are suggesting is that it's the decay of inflatons into sterile neutrinos that explains all these characteristics that we see here. So he says, the problem is we've been looking at the wrong decay mechanism. And because of that wrong decay mechanism, that decay mechanism of inflatons in the sterile neutrinos would actually predict that these ultra-dwarf galaxies would not produce a measurable signal. So he explains why we're not seeing the signal, but he says it also predicts where we would see a signal, which would be in the exotic dark matter that surrounds the center of our galaxy. So what they're saying is, let's look at the center of our galaxy, let's look at a different frequency of X-ray radiation because the decay of inflatons into sterile neutrinos predicts that we're going to see the sterile neutrinos at a different mass level. So he says we've been looking in the wrong place, wrong frequency, and we've identified the wrong mechanism that identifies or produces the sterile neutrinos. Now, what's wonderful about their suggestion is that the decay of inflatons into sterile neutrinos takes place through the agency of a very low mass inflaton. And the lowest mass inflaton that we know of, or as a possibility, is a particle called the axion. Now, what's wonderful about the axion is that could be the predominant particle that makes up exotic dark matter. That's been a presumption that physicists have had now for 10 years, that you've got ordinary neutrinos, which make up a tiny fraction, you've got the sterile neutrinos, which makes up another big chunk, but put them all together, it's still just a minority. You need the axions to really explain the rest of the exotic dark matter. And so these two gentlemen have come up with an explanation that would predict a great abundance of axions at a very low mass and would predict the sterile neutrinos, but would predict that the radiation would come out at a different wavelength and in a different location in terms of being the easiest place it could be seen. And finally, they wrap up their paper saying, we think it's already been detected, because they refer to research papers that say, we see an excess of X-ray radiation coming out of the center of the galaxy. And the astronomers that discovered it said, we're mystified. We have no idea what this excess radiation is. Now, this sounds remarkably like what happened back in 1964, where a couple of Bell Laboratory physicists won the Nobel Prize for a paper that was titled Excess Radiation. That was the beginning of the paper, but what they found was the radiation from the cosmic creation event. And so they had this little telescope outside of Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, and they were seeing an excess amount of radiation at a certain wavelength, had no idea what it was, and began calling around. And they actually contacted a physicist at Princeton University, Dickey, and Robert Dickey. And Dickey says, I know exactly what your excess radiation is. It's something I've been looking for most of my life, the radiation from the cosmic creation event. And so that's why Arnold Penzias and Robert Wilson won the Nobel Prize for discovering this excess radiation. Although I've always thought that Robert Dickey deserved a share of that prize, because he was actually searching for the radiation. He was the one that predicted 20 years previous what that radiation should look like and how bright it should be, and actually had already built a radiometer to look for it when he got a phone call from Arnold Penzias saying, can you explain what this excess radiation is? And if you look in the Astrophysical Journal, the two papers are published side by side. One by Arnold Penzias and Wilson, and the other one by Robert Dickey and another astronomer you've probably heard of, Wilkinson. The Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe satellite, the WMAP, is named after Dickey's student, Wilkinson, and it was Wilkinson that was commissioned by Dickey to build the radiometer in the 1960s to discover the radiation, but they got beat by a few days by Penzias and Wilson. So that's that story. But you know, I think we're seeing the story again. Here are these astronomers who found excess X-ray radiation coming to the center of the galaxy, had no clue what that excess is, but published it anyway. And now we have Joseph Silk coming along saying, I think I know what that excess radiation is. Now that's the good news. Here's the bad news. The excess radiation they have found comes in at about 3.5 to 4 times above the noise level of the X-ray radiation in that source. That means it does not count as a positive detection. And so I'm writing a paper on this where I say, probable detection of sterile neutrinos. It's not a definite detection, it's a probable detection. And so in physics, unless something is the signal is five times above the noise, we don't call it a positive identification. But when it's 3.5 to 4 times, that means it's more than just a possibility. That means it's probable. But you're not going to convince anybody until you get it up above 5 times. But I think what was most exciting to me about the paper, they said, here are some ways we can get the signal up high enough that it can win the Nobel Prize for somebody. Maybe not us, but somebody else. So that's kind of how they worded it. Namely, that we could go back to these dwarf galaxies, look at the appropriate wavelength with sufficient sensitivity and see if we see it there. And also try to look at, and by the way, there is two papers published where they said they found excess radiation coming out of the center of our Milky Way galaxy using two different telescopes. And so they said, okay, the British have found it with their telescope. The Americans have the Chandra telescope up there. What if we can use that to detect it? So that's what they were proposing. Let's focus. There's three X-ray telescopes up there. If all three of them see it, that would be very strong evidence for the existence of the sterile neutrino. And if we can actually find the signal in some place besides the center of the galaxy, that would be proved positive. So that's what they were proposing in their paper. What I'm suggesting is within a few months, that may be a done deal. We may actually have sterile neutrinos positively detected. And more than that, thanks to this paper published in the Astrophysical Journal, we're going to know the decay process and the physics of sterile neutrinos at a much higher level than we knew just a few weeks ago. So this is why I'm excited about it. This is probably the first time anything like this has been discussed in a church, but hey, you know. God did give us two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture. And to me, it's a real thrill what we're learning from the Book of Nature that is telling us about the handiwork of God. And I apologize for how technical the talk is, but I wanted you to appreciate this is really important stuff and gives us phenomenal new evidence for the handiwork of God that we've never had before. And it's got nothing to do with Psalm 139 that we're studying in the text, except for this. If it wasn't for these sterile neutrinos, there would be no human beings ever existing in the history of the universe, anytime, anywhere. So next time you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to put up a word of praise for God designing sterile neutrinos the way he did. All right, in the back. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you.
I just want to thank you very much. I believe you've changed my life right now. I was going to go back to university, but I decided not to because I didn't understand a word you said. Actually, I did want to ask you something about, you said inflation and the cosmic thing is good, but inflation in the economy is bad. Is that more?
Well, this morning I was joking with my wife, Kathy, that, you know, Congress, when they find out about these inflatons, they might really get excited as a way to solve the debt crisis that we're facing. But
actually, it was difficult following this, but just to kind of, I'm just curious, the beginning of time, the beginning of the universe, whatever, so one, say a second before any of this happened, there was nothing, is that correct? Or there was void, a void, nothingness, what was there?
Well, let me give you a passage from the book of Hebrews. It says the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. Now, what can we detect? We can detect within matter, energy, space, and time. So what Hebrews 11:3 is telling us is basically the same thing Genesis 1:1 tells us. The universe was created by God out of nothing. However, whenever a physicist says nothing, you have to ask him, what kind of nothing are you talking about? There are different levels of nothing. Hebrews 11:3 defines what that is. Namely, that the universe came about through God's hand from something that had nothing to do with matter, energy, space, and time. So he may have produced it from something beyond space, time, matter, and energy. Or he may have produced it from actual pure nothing. You know, all those options are open. But it did not come from that which we can possibly detect.
Okay, could you tell me what, in 100 words or less, let's say the very first second. I mean, what was the very first, what was the very first thing that happened that created this? What, did something collide with something? Did something come? What, I still don't understand what's...
Okay, let me give you a quick history of the first second of the existence of the universe. Okay. There was no time until God created the universe. There was no space until God created the universe, or matter and energy. And when God created the universe, all that existed that we can possibly detect or measure would be space curvature. There'd be 10 dimensions of space, all squished up into an infinitesimally small volume. That's what the very beginning of the universe looks like. However, these 10 space-time dimensions are dynamic. They're expanding. And when they expand, they release curvature. What I mean by that is the curvature of the lines of space of the universe become less and less curved as the universe expands, kind of like blowing up a beach ball. The degree of curvature becomes less and less as the beach ball gets bigger and bigger. Well, the release of space curvature is not nothing. That release of space curvature is a source of, quote, energy that is capable in due time of producing photons. So at the very beginning of the universe is dark. You have these 10 space-time dimensions squished up in an infinitesimally small volume, but that volume of 10 dimensions expands, and the release of space curvature produces the photon. You say, when does that happen? When the universe is less than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. So it happens very, very early in the history of the universe, so early that it's easy for us as physicists to say, when God created the universe, there was light immediately. Well, almost immediately there was light. Within a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, you get light. Now, as the universe continues to expand, that light will produce matter. So not until 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the cosmic creation event, roughly a billionth of a second, is when that energy, that light energy, is able to be converted into baryons and antibaryons. Then the baryons and the antibaryons undergo an annihilation event, which produces the protons, neutrons, and electrons that we see today. And as the universe continues to expand, there reaches a point where you can actually get atoms to form. So that will happen within the early history, but that takes a few minutes before that happens. So, and in between 3 minutes and 3 minutes and 20 seconds, all the universes in terms of ordinary matter is nothing but protons and neutrons. That's up to 3 minutes. Past 3 minutes, some of those protons and neutrons will coalesce to make helium and small amounts of lithium, beryllium, and boron. And then 200 million years later, you get stars, and it's those stars that make all the other elements we see in the universe. So that's a quick history of the universe.
What was the very first, what was the first thing produced? Do you call it a baryon?
Baryon.
Baryon.
Yeah. Baryons don't show up until 10 to the minus 11 seconds after the universe exists. So you got to wait that long before you get any matter.
So the baryons are what do you call them, the sterile
No, the neutrinos exist before the baryons exist.
So the neutrinos were probably
So you got inflatons existing when the universe is only a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old.
But it was a form of energy that produced this, right? It was energy.
But that energy comes from the release of space curvature.
And what do scientists say where that energy came from? Or is that where you get into God?
That's where you get into God. God made the 10 space-time dimensions in a highly curved state. And he designed it in such a way that it would unfold according to his plan to make inflatons, neutrinos of the various kinds, and eventually the baryons, with a slight imbalance of baryons being a little bit more abundant than the antibaryons, which would allow us to have galaxies, stars, and planets of the right type showing up at the right time so that life would be possible.
Just one quick.
So that's a quick story of how we got here.
Well, Stephen Hawking, what does he say about the energy, where that came from? How would he explain that?
Well, where he would differ from me is he would say you don't need a personal God to make those 10 highly curved space-time dimensions. He says you're going to need some intelligent being or intelligent entity, but he's arguing that it's not a personal entity. Now, the problem with that is you need a personal entity to get design. Non-personal entities can't design things. But you know, his whole position is that there is some kind of entity out there, call him God if you wish, that is responsible for all the equations of physics, the mathematics, and the physics, and somehow that produces everything thereafter without the need for the intervention of a personal agency. Although some friends of Hawking suggested maybe Hawking's not denying a personal God, but he's saying that the personal God only intervenes at the very beginning of the creation of the universe. So in that sense, as I've looked in his books over the years, I see him as a deist, not an atheist, not an agnostic, but a deist.
Where does God go once he creates the universe?
He takes a 14 billion year long vacation. So it's basically God is only involved at the beginning of the universe.
A big hiatus.
A big hiatus. Well, I mean, you can see why that's attractive to somebody who doesn't want a higher being in authority over their life. And that's something all of us human beings struggle with. We all struggle with the idea there's a higher being up there that's going to tell us how we should live our lives. And in our rebellion, we say, we don't want anybody telling us what to do, but that would logically imply that it must be a God who doesn't care what we do. And therefore, we have God only active at the beginning and taking a 14 billion year long vacation, or some say a 14 billion year long nap, then I don't have to worry about what God's telling me to do in terms of how I run my life. So that's kind of where the science and the philosophy intersect. So it's something you see in the book of Romans, is that God's creative power is revealed to all, but that we tend to impose a self-imposed ignorance upon ourselves to hide us from the fact that if that's really true, then there is someone who has authority over my life. Question over here.
You know, I've talked to you personally about that the moment of formation, but since we're kind of sensitized to this moment, just for a layperson to understand, at that moment of that expansion occurring, my first question is it in excess of the speed of light? Therefore, the light that you say form, this expansion would outpace light. And then two, you know, if you were to put a distance, you know, if you could somehow put a timeline, you know, of distance versus this detonation, if you were to take your folding chair in space, as you knew it, away from this detonation, where would you set it up to enjoy the view blue that came out towards you?
Okay. First of all, where your question is, does it ever expand faster than the velocity of light? Yes, it does. and expands millions of times faster than the velocity of light, more so than that again.
So this would basically be dark at some...
It's devoid of photons. The photons show up right at the inflation event. It's the inflation event where you get the inflatons and the photons are showing up. But this period of very rapid expansion, far, far faster than the velocity of light, lasts only for an extremely brief period of time. It takes place between the epoch when the universe is 10 to the minus 35 seconds old and it's 10 to the minus 34 seconds old. So, I mean, we're talking the tiniest split second is when you get this hyperinflation. You say, what stops the hyperinflation is something called symmetry breaking. You say, what's that all about? Well, the universe is basically cooling down as it expands. Basic principle of physics. If you expand a system, it gets colder. And we know when things get colder and colder, there's certain temperatures where you get symmetry breaking. Let me give you an easy example. I think I've shared this with a class before. If you take a bar magnet and heat it up to about 500 degrees centigrade, it reaches a point where you can't see any magnetism any longer. Well, what's really going on is the magnetic energy blends with the heat energy. It's not that it's disappeared, but they blend together. And when you cool the magnet, you get what's called symmetry breaking, where this a heat magnetic energy source splits into two, heat and magnetism. Well, the same thing's true of the universe. As the universe gets colder and colder, you have a single unified force of physics. And as the universe cools, it goes into two forces of physics, and as it gets colder, three forces of physics, and finally, four forces of physics. Now, when does all that happen? Well, by the time the universe is a billionth of a second old, you've got four forces of physics. So all the symmetry breaking happens when the universe is very young. But when the strong nuclear force separates from the electroweak force is when you get the inflation. And so whenever you get symmetry breaking, you can get exotic physics taking place. But now what these physicists are saying is it's the inflatons that make it all happen. And because of the inflatons, we get axions and we get stereoneutrinos, and that really explains all the exotic matter, or almost all the exotic matter, we see in the universe today. And also simultaneously solves these eight problems. So this is why I think this is Nobel Prize winning stuff. I mean, it just answers so many wonderful questions that we have in physics and astronomy, and gives us so much more evidence for supernatural design than we've had before. And you're telling me I'm out of time. Universe is not a time, but we're out of time. Okay, a quick question, and then we're going to close. Okay, you two guys get the last word. Go ahead.
Okay, it seems to me like if God wanted to be a personal God, he would have taken 13 billion years or so to create humans so that he could be person of our personal God. And the other thing is, how do you measure the middle, the center of the universe?
The universe does not have a center. Just like there's no center on the surface of the Earth, okay?
In the middle of the center of the universe.
Space and time only exist on the surface of the universe. So there is no place where you can go and say that's the center. Unless you do this. You look back in time and the surface of the universe is smaller. So the farther away you look and the farther back in time, the smaller the surface becomes and the more consistent it would become from the actual point from which the universe began. But there is no geometric center to the universe. In response to your first comment, yes, God could have done things a whole lot more rapidly than 14 billion years, but it would have required different physics for the universe. And a different physics would have posed a problem from God's perspective to bring about the end of all evil and suffering quickly in the human context. It's because of the physics of the universe that when God creates human beings, he can permanently remove evil and suffering in thousands of years, not trillions or billions of years. But in order to make it happen as fast as thousands of years in the human context, it's crucial that the universe be billions of years old. Now, as a physicist, I could think of ways God could also bring about the conquest of evil quickly, but it would require universes that would be quadrillions of years old. You can't make it any younger than 14 billion years, approximately, if God's goal is to use the physics of the universe as a tool to bring about a rapid conquest of evil and suffering. So we live in a remarkably young universe. As a physicist, I'm astounded how young the universe is, given everything that God wants to do with the universe. And Al, I'm really challenging you once again. Read why the universe is the way it is, because it really explains all this in layman's language. Okay, you got the last comment.
Just real quickly, how big was the universe after 1 second? How big was it? Size of this room or the size of...
No, by the time it's a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, just after the inflationary era, after 10 to the minus 34 seconds, the universe is a little bit bigger than a grapefruit.
Than a grapefruit?
Than a
grapefruit. Really?
But you know, if you go just a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second earlier than that, it's smaller than an electron. It goes from the size of an electron to the size of a grapefruit in just 10 to the minus 34 seconds. And that requires it expanding at, you know, trillions of times faster than the velocity of light to get it that big in that short of a period of time. Oh, by 5 minutes, I'd have to work that out. I can't do that off the top of my head. I'm sorry, not in the time I've got allotted to close this class. And I got to close right now. So I'll take questions privately afterwards. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had together. And Lord, we thank you that, you know, as we study the universe, there's no way we can plumb the depths of everything you've done on our behalf. And we thank you, Lord, for how these sterile neutrinos just show you the degree of fine-tuning design that you inputted into the physics of the universe to make our very existence possible. Father, we look forward eagerly to the huge advances that are in the offing in just the next few months from these sterile neutrinos that will show your handiwork like physics has never shown it before. So, Father, I pray, too, that this would give us a greater appreciation for what you revealed in your word, and, Lord, would give us more motivation to uncover the reasons that we have to believe in you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.